tell her what the young boy gon' do. Damn them chicks with you, gotta be a king. They pretty thick with a kick that's sick, that need to be hit. So tell me what y'all gon' do.
Breezy, coming to South Africa supposedly the 14th of December, and a lady in Limpopo sold 800 Breezy tickets at $4,500 a pop, and she still had 1,200 left to sell afterward. Of course, these are fake tickets.
Oh, I'm going to say, because like,
but she single-handedly took this Chris Breezy thing and turned it into 3.6 million rand.
Okay. Who are these people buying the tickets? Don't you know you got to go to CompuTicket? In the olden days, I'm old enough to remember when this stuff happened, you went to your local CompuTicket and you queued from sunrise to get tickets.
Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore. Now you can just phone somebody.
Click, and get illegal ones in Limpopo.
There you go.
Limpopo, hey.
How to become a millionaire. Let's get the show on the road.
Unfiltered opinions.
Ideas and you're not quite sure why.
As you secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Moya.
I'm Nicolette Mashile.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Market matters. We're taking a look at the US CPI data that's come out this week. We're also taking a look at the passing of a business tycoon in Ratan Tata. He built the Tata empire to what we know it to be today. And we're also going to touch on Google's woes. They seem to have attracted the wrong kind of attention, if that's even possible for them. US CPI, I suppose that's the softest story that we have this week to kick off in Market Matters. I mean, expected, everything on target, no one surprised.
Yeah, maybe not as good as everyone had hoped, but I mean, all just going in the right direction, right? I mean, interestingly, so last week after we recorded, we got the jobs data, unemployment went down. I mean,
surprise, surprise.
In the American market. But it's all going in the right direction. And then we got the FOMC minutes, which I went and read because I'm nerdy like that. And they're very nerdy. And it doesn't say, it'll say like some or a few or many. So it doesn't give names and stuff. But I got to say, reading between the lines, which maybe I did too much reading between the lines after a whiskey, it seemed to suggest that actually, 25 was the more likely, but there was a bit of elbowing and therefore got it to 250. Mm. But I think we're going to see quarter cuts for the next two meetings this year. We're not going to get another 50, surely.
I don't think so. I think 50 might be a bit aggressive. I don't think there's a reason for a 50.
No reason.
The US Fed kind of took the approach to say, we are going to show the world that we're going to control the narrative. We're going to ensure a soft landing. We're going to get inflation to where we want it to be. And I mean, coming in at 2.5 instead of 2.4? Was it 2.4 instead of 2.3?
Yeah, 2.4 instead of 0.3.
Either way, if your inflation went from 2% to 9% back to 2%, you've done your job.
Yeah. So it came in 2.4, previous 2.5, expected was 2.3. I mean, we're splitting hairs here. I agree with you 100%. And someone, I think Claudia Sham, who did the Sham rule, she was on Bloomberg this week. And I didn't see her on Bloomberg. I saw her on Twitter. And she's like, Jerome Powell is the goat of central bankers.
He is.
Because, as you say, from 9.1 to 2.4 with no, I mean, a bit of pain, but like, meh.
No, so I think there's a couple of factors here, of course. I mean, we can't discount the big US stimulus. We seem to have forgotten that there was a more than $2 trillion stimulus in the pandemic.
Cash into your hand.
Exactly, that helped cushion the blow. And I think that's part of the reason why we could probably end up with a much softer landing than what was anticipated. I know Pietri and a couple of other guys are still on the recession will happen. But if you look at how everything is playing out, it's in no one's interests for a recession to happen. Typically, if a recession happens, a country like the US comes out of it on top. Because if you go in first, you can manage it best. Everybody else is the ripple effect. But this time around, if the US tips into a recession, and you've got economies like China that are saying, we'll take off the load. You've got the Middle East saying, we'll still produce oil. There's no real reset that comes out of a US-led recession. But there is a strategic advantage to ensuring a soft landing because you maintain your position atop of the food chain, so to speak.
Yeah, 100%. Agreed, 100%. And I think there's a couple of important facts. So Petri's concerned because he says every time, but actually he means in the last 25 years, because youngins don't go far back, that rates have been cut, there's been a recession. Sure, but it was 2008 and 2001. I mean, there were other things happening which caused it. Fun fact, every time rate cutting has started with the S&P within a percent of all-time highs, the one-year return has been 18%. We're just seeing data left, right, and center that says, actually, this market's going higher. And S&P's almost a fraction off all-time highs. NVIDIA's back on the go again. CrowdStrike is having – man, this is a bull market. And there's one thing you do in a bull market. Be long.
Be long.
Be long.
Are you going to be long if you're Google? So the most interesting thing happened – I think it was yesterday I saw an article – about Google's legal woes.
Yeah.
The United States government is potentially looking to have Google unbundle the business. So separate Android out of Google, separate Chrome out of Google.
DoubleClick maybe as well, which is their ad business.
And what that kind of unbundling or separation or split or whatever looks like, we don't know yet. So I don't want to say it's going to be separately listed things or it's going to be new entities or whatever. But the point is the US government is looking at Google, and they say that because I think there's some stat that says about 90% of search transactions in the US are processed by Google. And the US government is seeing this as a illegal monopoly that Google has now built. Not only
you'd like to be a monopoly, an abusive monopoly. They're abusing their monopoly status. It's legal to be a monopoly. You just can't abuse that power.
But from the country that for centuries has been build the American dream. We are capitalism. This is capitalism. Capitalism is great. Donald Trump's entire campaign is running on capitalism right now. You're going to come out and have a problem with your own company that has done capitalism too well?
Yeah, so it's the locking out of others. And so, for example, Android, they got into trouble in the EU because if you were using – so Android's open source. Anyone mm-hmm. can put it on a phone. But if you put it on a phone, you had to bundle the Google Play Store mm-hmm. and Office and all of that. Well, mm-hmm. not there. What's there? Google Sheets and everything. And that had to be default. And the EU's like, you can't make that default. You mm-hmm. can't instruct – you can't say it's free and then there's T's and C's. And what they've got caught in the US is abusing their monopoly power. I think so, and this is going to play out. Remember Microsoft, by the time nothing happened, like it had all moved on anyway. So there will be arguments made because Google lost the court case. Arguments will be made in November. It will go to trial in terms of what will the punishment be in August of next year. Google will appeal it. This thing is going to take forever. I think the one they're going to do, they're not going to unbundle Chrome or DoubleClick or any of that, but they pay $20 billion a year to the likes of Samsung and Apple, or is it per quarter maybe, to be the default search on those phones. I think they're going to prevent that happening. And the hit there is more Samsung and Apple, more Apple than actually Google. So the remedy's not going to remedy much anyway.
But let's just take a step back, Sai. It's a capitalist economy. The company did capitalistic things. Why is anyone surprised here?
Because you're not allowed to be...
You can't be good at your job.
No, you can be good at your job. You can't abuse it. I know. There's a very... But if you go back 100 years, I mean, Standard Oil and all of those. I mean, AT&T in the 80s. I mean, America has done this before where they break companies up. And in both cases, and particularly if we look at AT&T, when they broke AT&T, and that's because I remember it more than 100 years ago. When you look at the breakup of AT&T, it worked. I mean... telephone prices collapsed in the US, which was good for the consumer. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, US competition law is much more focused on the consumer, which is why I was surprised why Google lost. Because whether, you know, I've got Google as a default on my Apple, so what? It's good for me that, you know, in the EU, it's more focused on the impact on your competing companies. Mm. But I hear you. I mean, I think it's a fine line, and certainly it's Lina Khan, the new FCC chair, who's pushing this. Mm. She might be out of a job come 20 January, depending who wins next month. But it's like you can take it so far, but you can't abuse the position. And that is a gray area.
That's a very fine line because...
Well, that's why they haven't broken Google, anyone up in 40 years.
Yeah, but Google can also argue the fact that we built a service
yeah.
that people use
yeah.
of their own accord. Anyone else can build an alternative service should you wish to.
Yeah.
The fact that someone like a Samsung is willing to sign a commercial agreement with us for us to be the default browser on there, the fact that Apple is willing to do that simply means that our product is good.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, 5 years ago, I was all in on Google, right? Everything on my computer was Google. I don't use Google Search anymore because I think it's gone to the birds. I don't use Chrome because it wants more memory than God has got. That sort of thing. So there are alternatives. Now, I appreciate that for many people, it's just easier to
convenience. Go with
the flow. But you have alternatives. I have Chrome on my computer, but my default browser is Arc. I use Perplexity for my default search. I mean, it.
Yeah, so I mean, from Google's perspective, and I mean, I'm looking at it, I'm trying to be objective about it, right? Mm-hmm. I understand the abuse conversation around, yes, you can't do this. But the only way a market gets into an abusive state like that is if nobody's challenging them. If you think about any kind of... Or because
their product is so immensely
superior,
good.
Exactly. So they've never once said, no one can come and launch a Bing, a Brave,
yeah.
a DuckDuckGo yeah. in the US and come and do it. They said, look, it's fine. Come into the space. By all means, we're happy to take this on. I understand the EU case. That was a different case where...
Yeah, where
and I remember this was similar to how they treated the Huawei case where... Huawei's would not have access to Google Play Store and all of those things as part of the trade war. That's something completely sure. different. But again, at the center of that trade war was the United States saying, we're going to protect US businesses and put America first. Now you're saying the same US business is not putting Americans first?
Yeah, no, 100%. And it comes to the point, as you say, anyone can start a competing product. Help yourself.
Help yourself. No one's ever, Google's never stopped anyone from doing that. But let's move on to some unfortunate news. But we reflect on them in a positive light. The passing of Ratan Tata, who was instrumental to the Tata Empire and putting it where it is now. I mean, the announcement of the passing came through this week. And off the back of that announcement, the share price moved quite a bit. But you were saying something very interesting about the amount of companies?
150 companies, operations in 100 countries. And you're like, well, what are these? I bet I've never heard of the companies. You absolutely have. I mean, it's and now the list of the companies is gone. It's Air India, for example. He's got Tata Steel. We know about that. Tata Power, Tata Projects, Tata Housing, Tata Motors, which owns Jaguar and Land Rover. Mm-hmm. And others. Tata Chemicals. I mean, when you think about conglomerates, your mind sort of goes to Berkshire Hathaway.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. I tell you what, your mind should go to this as well. It is just insane in terms of what they hold. And it was started by, and we can't work out the lineage, but it was started in 1939, which was a great, great, great...
1939. Sorry, 1839.
My bad. Sorry, born then. Started 1868, 156 years old. It is just, you know, it's automotive, it's jewelry, it's home appliances, it is aerospace, it is everything. When you start to dig into it, it is an insane company. Insane in the good sense.
Do you know who started it?
Jacinta Tata.
That's interesting. We'll see if we can find a connection to the lineage. But yes, we're saddened by the passing. It's always interesting to reflect on legacies, and we tend to do that in hindsight and not necessarily while the legacy is being built and while the legacy is ongoing. It's very rare that we look at situations and say, this is happening now in our lifetime. And this is one of those times where you look back and you say this. I mean, this business is, it's not a small business at all.
It's $400 billion if you put it all together. And what's really interesting with it is that, you know, the whole thing with conglomerates, you know, and we've got a few in South Africa as well, is it's around capital allocation, right? You're making money from your various different businesses. What do you do with it? You know, Berkshire makes a ton from Sears, but doesn't put it back into Sears because really they make candy. They made it the same way for 100 years. In America, that's not candy. It's chocolate. Anyway, where do you put that money to? So you got this dividend flow. Now, where do you allocate that dividend flow? Bidvest, Bidcorp, I mean, two examples of it. Remgro, it's that capital allocation where it can go horribly wrong, but it can also horribly right. And when it goes horribly right, you've got this cash producer that just keeps on throwing money at you that you can then go and, you know, not put it back into the business the money came out of, but put it into a business that needs it or buy one or whatever the case might be. Conglomerates done well, and they're not always done well, are powerful, powerful businesses.
LVMH. We spoke about this in the luxury space.
Yeah, LVMH.
You can't deny Bernard Arnault's positioning in not only the Forbes ranking list, but in the luxury space. And to your point around the Remgro business, Johann Rupert Richemont, I think what I appreciate about the Tata Group and all of these conglomerates is the ability to diversify, but diversify effectively. Yes. So not just, and I mean, when you look at something like the Tata Group, you think, okay, 150 businesses across many sectors is too diversified. But I suppose that's what happens when you get bored of the sectors that you're already in and you dominate. I mean, you get to a point where you're like, okay, this is enough for us. And what's next?
Yeah,
what do we do from here?
How do you move a needle in that sort of business? 100%. But it is interesting. I mean, it's just essentially portfolio construction, right? I mean, so the benefit that they have is they can go into unlisted space. We can't because our checkbooks aren't big enough. But it's building that portfolio. And then the dividends flow. And initially, the dividends aren't much, but then they become chunky. And if you don't need it because you're living off it, you're like, well, hey, I've got some dividends over the last quarter. What should I go and buy? But then to your point, do you become overly diversified? Now, they were quite concentrated in terms of geographic India, but not massively so. I mean, not exclusively. They've got a lot of businesses that operate beyond the borders. They've got businesses that are not Indian. They got Jaguar in there. You know, lots of people buy Jaguars.
Which that concentration you'd think would be somewhat of a problem if you think about just how interconnected the world is. But if you look at where the shift is happening right now in terms of allocation of resources, whether it's human capital or intellectual capital, you've built a brand in a country that is now officially the most populated on earth. And those people can now take that same brand out into the rest of the world because they know it. They use it. They've used it all their lives.
Yeah, no, 100%. Absolutely, you can. You absolutely can. And it's weird because they're not the only. If you look at the Nifty 50, the big stocks, and it's Reliance is the other one. Also, this giant conglomerate that when the patriarch decided he'd had enough, broke it into two pieces, gave the communication part to the one son and the telcos part to the other son. It's a weird market in many senses, different to you know, a lot of that sort of large patriarch family type businesses in the Indian market.
The Reliance Group, for those that are slightly confused, is the empire that is now controlled by Mukesh Ambani. That's where we're going to leave Market Matters this week. We move on to our deep dive. We're taking a look at government bailouts and stimulus, whether it's from a government level or a state-owned entity level. There's lots to look into. There's various reasons why these things happen. But all in all, we're being told by the governments that make these decisions that this is for the greater good. Is it?
Depends. I mean, difference between bailouts and stimulus. Stimulus, if done for the right reason and if done well. I mean, it was Ben Bernanke who once said, was it Ben Bernanke? You know, just helicopter money, just literally throw money. And that's what they did in the pandemic. We kind of did it in the sense that we did the SDR grants, 350 rand a person, no questions asked. You come and get your money because, hey, pandemic. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, I can't roll that back because there's always an election around the corner. So stimulus, yes, with T's and C's. And we spoke about the 9.1% inflation in the US. So sometimes those T's and C's can really, really hurt. But it got through people a really, really tough time. Bailouts is a whole different kettle of fish. Who are you bailing? Why are you bailing them? Are they really important? Are they important for jobs, i.e. unions and votes perhaps? Are they important for economies? Are they important for prestige? I mean, I would argue that SAA only really ticked prestige more than anything else. So those I'm less convinced about.
How do you get them right? Because 2008 financial crisis happens. The U.S. president at the time, George W. Bush, signs a $700 billion bailout for the U.S. financial system as a bill that goes through, goes into the economy. Looks very different from the U.S. stimulus of $2 trillion that we got in the pandemic that we just spoke about. How do you get it right to put the bailout through, or the stimulus, or however you want to label it, and have it be beneficial? I mean, obviously, a huge percentage or a huge portion of that benefit relies on you actually doing the right thing with the money. I mean, I think about a couple of things that have happened in the pandemic where we got some financial assistance or financial assistance to transition to green energies, and that hasn't gone through as well. So that kind of stimulus or injection didn't have the desired outcome. So how do you get it right?
Yeah, so that's almost industrial policy you're touching on now, and America's struggling with that in terms of their CHIPS Act and Intel and all of that. It's one thing to say we need to make our own chips. Here's $40 billion to do it. It's another thing to really, really make it actually happen. Mm. And that is the sort of the interfering of almost command economy, of which you've got the likes of China in the one extreme and then America supposedly on the other extreme with Europe in the middle. The stimulus, I mean, it works, right? So let's look at the pandemic. If there hadn't been a stimulus, there would have been a really chronic recession, surely. People just lost jobs, because in America, you can like fire and hire as you like. Mm-hmm. So people would have just lost jobs. The economy was grinding to a halt, but at least there was money moving. Yeah, it was going to Amazon and other online services, but there was stuff happening. There was money moving and the like. Without it, you know, we would have had a very severe recession, which would have been immensely difficult to get out of. And I appreciate that, you know, that stimulus money, you know, saw inflation rise, added markedly to the debt profile in the US. But I got to say, the other side of the coin, and we don't know what it would have been like, could potentially have been multitudes worse. Not necessarily, it wouldn't have been inflation, but it would have been still debt, because tax revenues would absolutely have cratered. They would have just, you know, it would have been unemployment, you know, the unemployment what went to close on 20%. It wouldn't have recovered particularly quickly at all. The stimulus, I think, if well used, is a good idea. Some of it's going to be abused, some of it's not going to be very efficient, but I think the stimulus works. The bailing out.
You say that this is a debt conversation in part around how to manage the debt. Mm. But surely some people don't care. And I say don't care because you look at global debts, right? You look at how much South Africa is indebted to other countries and all of that. You can do a ranking of the top 10 most indebted countries or most indebted regions in the world. Mm. And South Africa doesn't even feature in that list. We're no one there, right? But what's particularly interesting is, and it probably comes back to the conversation we had a little earlier on around the fine line between abuse and not abuse, right? The entire European Union, the debt for the EU sits at around 17.1 trillion US dollars. The entire debt for the United States of America alone sits at double that amount, at $34 trillion. So if you are trying to manage things and trying to manage your debt, since 1960, so from 1960 to today, call it 65 years to be exact, you've raised the debt ceiling 78 times. On average, more than once a year, you're raising the debt ceiling. At what point or you say, is it a bailout? Is it a stimulus? Are you just making your own rules as you go along?
Well, so now you put your foot very pushed open that door. Modern monetary theory. I mean, this is essentially what it is, right? And let's look at the US and America. Broadly the same population sizes, 300, 350 million or there's about. If you say which is more economically efficient, America by 100-fold. Weirdly, Europe with only half the debt has got safety nets left, right, and center. I mean, it's socialist. It borderline socialist in some cases, just out and out socialist.
So the free market United States that's banning Google, same one,
and won't let you have medical stuff.
Okay, now I'm just
somehow manages to have twice as much debt as the folks who will pay for your medical and. Anyway, so modern monetary theory, and I'm going to bastardize this, but let me basically say that, sure, America's got 30-odd trillion dollars of debt, etc. But what did they get for it? Because let's look at a country with a balance sheet, right? And the one side of a balance sheet is your debt, and they've got 30-plus trillion on it. On the other side is, you know, bridges and hospitals, and some of them are private, some of them are public-owned. But you've got those utilities, whatever they are, that are – that enable an economy, the roads and all of those sort of things that enable an economy to actually go. Modern monetary theory says, don't be scared of debt. Debt is good. If you spend R1 billion on or dollars on a bridge and the bridge costs R1 billion, but what's the bridge's actual value? It's not R1 billion. It's got utility. People can get across it. It saves time going around, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It'll earn you back that billion multitude of ways and multitude of times over. So you spend the money, and weirdly, it goes back to Europe versus America. One has chronic debt and yet has a much bigger and more booming economy. You know, Europe would love to be doing the 2 or 3% that America can cruise at in terms of GDP growth. And the other side, you've got the socialist environment, but scared of debt and therefore just not growing and not the booming economy by any stretch.
So then why are emerging markets taught to keep your debt to GDP ratio under wraps, to not borrow too much, to not build infrastructure, to not inject money into your own economy unless it's a third party's financing into your economy? Why is if we're looking at debt to GDP as a measure of stability, which supposedly is one of those measures that emerging markets are tasked with, our finance minister in South Africa says you have to maintain a modest debt to GDP. We have to keep it under 80%. We have to get it back down to 60% or whatever it is. Yet countries like the United States are north of 100+%.
Yeah. So why? I mean, because winners make the rules. I mean, it's the same story. If the average Chinese citizen used as much oil as the average American, this planet would have boiled over a decade ago. I mean, not just got hot, it would have boiled and, you know, crashed into the sun. Why? Because let's take South Africa. And so let's say we increase our debt 50%. And let's say we do it efficiently. We build hospitals and schools and fast trains and all of those sort of things. And there was no corruption and all of that, and was efficiently done and cost effectively and everything else. We would have a markedly better economy that would be growing faster, generating more taxes, enabling you to pay that debt down, enabling you to borrow more money so we could build our own little SpaceX in Virginia where we've got helium. So I'm not convinced by this whole, why is America at 120% or whatever it is, jet to GDP, telling South Africa,
60%.
That's so dangerous.
Naughty.
How come? Come on, you guys got to where you are by getting drunk on debt. Why can't we get drunk on debt too? Now, there is a risk that we take our debt and we increase it 50% and
we have nothing to show for
politicians buy motor cars.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, that is without a shadow of a doubt. But if we can, in a hypothetical where there is no friction and corruption and all of that sort of chaos, then why is debt scary? We let South Africans who earn, you know, $1 million a year, we'll let them buy a house for $3 million and a car and a, you know, so what is this? It's almost the, I almost want to say it's the global apartheid almost in a sense.
No, but you said it. You said the sentence, and that's the sentence I'm going to hold on to. Winners make the rules.
Yeah.
Because on our social pages, there's a debate that's going around ratings agencies, and there's a couple of comments that are coming through saying that those that make the decisions, those that have control over the US dollar, have the control over the ratings agencies. Winners make the rules. In the South African context, as you brought up, the financing side of it, banks make the rules, right?
Yeah.
So the banks have the debt. The banks sit there and use our money to loan it back to us and charge us the premium for that service. And they make the rules around how much we must pay, when we must pay back, how much they can charge.
I was running the numbers. I put a tweet out. I've finally sold my apartments. I own no property for the first time since 1998, December. Mm-hmm. And it really excites me. So, of course, everyone gets angry. So I did on my show this morning. I go run the numbers. You know who makes money in the property market?
Banks.
Correct. You know who else makes money in the property market?
No
one. Banks. No, it's just banks. Your million-rand apartment that you paid off over 20 years – They made $1.5 million for something that is a low-risk loan because you can't take the house and move it to somewhere else.
But it's not just the property space. It's every asset you can think of that needs to be financed in the vehicle space as well. Mm. You have the vehicle. It's financed by the bank. And you look at your installment sale agreement. You look at your mortgage agreement. Mm. Any agreement you look at, there is – and it's only because banks have to now disclose this information. They're required by law. I remember a time where you weren't required by law to disclose exactly how much interest you're going to make over that term of that contract and what proportion of that interest that is to the principal.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever seen an agreement where your financing or the interest component is less than 1 point something times of the principal amount. So they recover the principal amount in its entirety. They have the asset as collateral sitting underneath that and they make money. So that's any real asset that you get financed. And on top of that, they still have a banking premium that they get from the central banks.
Mm.
Ooh, we're going to do a deep dive on banks.
So my grandfather always said, start a bank, start a religion.
Okay. Take me through that second one.
They make money. Religious churches don't pay tax.
Hmm.
Yeah.
We're not encouraging it. That's what the law says. We didn't make the rules. Somebody else did. So when the bailout conversation happens and we're in a country like South Africa where you're stuck with an unemployment rate where it's sitting at. I think those are other factors as well that people don't take into account. So you look at something like the United States, they're able to run whatever conversation they want to run. They're able to be the winners in every conversation because you look at their unemployment rate, it's sitting below 5%.
Yeah.
You look at China, their unemployment rate is sitting below 5% and they have 1 billion people.
Yeah.
You look at South Africa, we've got a fraction of those amount of people. We've got an unemployment rate sitting at 30%. How do you now reconcile those factors? Because as you said, the reality around injecting stimulus into a country, into the country's ecosystem and its economy, building those roads, building those schools and all of that, is that someone needs to do the building. That creates jobs.
Yeah.
Someone needs to consume what has been built, whether it's a service, whether it's a utility, whether it's a product. Someone needs to consume that. That adds to the economy. Someone needs to get paid to service the people consuming. So the ripple effect of solving unemployment, for years we've always said is infrastructure development, because it is. And the question then becomes, so then why isn't it being done?
Well, why isn't it being, maybe it's been done and it's just been done inefficiently.
Could it be our education
system? We spend about 10 times more money per kid than Mozambique, and yet Mozambican kids are probably 10 times smarter than our kids. We're spending, but you can spend the money and just not get that reward back for it.
How do you put in place those safeguards to ensure that you do? So without becoming China, which nothing against China and how they've decided to make the decisions that they've made. But they've taken a very socialist approach to say, we're going to make these decisions and the Chinese government is going to do it for the greater good of the Chinese people, regardless of what the Chinese people say in certain respects. I mean, going after the rich and all of that stuff. That requires a degree of discipline as the people that are in charge to make that decision and effect that decision and understand what the greater good means. And it comes back to a conversation we had with Pietri around a scarcity mindset when you were in, I remember you were in Durban for the for this. And Pietri said, in a scarcity mindset, those that have not had, when they finally have, still live in that scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
And how do you then shift that mindset to then say, if there is, because I've always believed that there's enough money in the South African ecosystem, the South African economy to grow this economy quite well. It just is managed inefficiently, right? How do you manage it more efficiently?
The one way is hold people accountable. In other words, jail corruptees. I mean, just that simple. Is it surely because it's that inefficiency? It is the leakage. I mean, I said a moment ago when I said if we double or increase our debt by 50%, but it's the leakage that goes through it. We are as a country immensely inefficient at spending the money that we have, and so we spend, pick a number, 10 billion on something, but we don't spend 10 billion on something. We spend 3 or 4. So then we're looking for a return on our 10 billion, but actually we got a return on 3, and we might have got a good return on 3. but not relative to
what we outlaid.
To what we outlaid. And particularly when you look at the bailouts at the SOEs. I mean, the SOE bailouts was just throwing good money after bad again and again and again. And surely, and this is what the current finance minister is doing with Eskom. He's saying, cuckoo, we will help you with your debt, mm-hmm. but here's all the T's and C's. Mm. Here's all what you have to do, when you have to do it by. And as you tick off, I will EFT you some money. Mm. And until you don't tick it off, there is no money coming. In other words, I'm going to say it's carrot and stick. It's not. It's saying these are the measurables that we need. This is because otherwise you throw 200 billion at Eskom to help with the debt scenario, and next year Eskom's back in debt again. And you're like, yo, what happened? It's like, how are you going to address this? How are you going to get your collections up so that you've got less, you know, municipalities owing you money? How are you going to get your energy availability factors up? Those easy to measure, in all cases, metrics. You do them, you get it.
Government debts and bailouts, they are nothing without efficiency and KPIs. That's the deep dive. And we wrap things up with our investor insights. We're taking a look at a couple of picks. But before we get to the picks, we're looking at some very interesting announcements from our receiver of revenue. SARS has made a very clear and cautionary statement around crypto taxation.
Mm.
Ooh. SARS is coming after everyone.
Yeah, has been forever. Like, oaks are up in arms. Like, I'm confused.
This is not new.
I'm very, very confused. Firstly, the blockchain is not half as anonymous as people think it is. Trust me, every government entity the world over, and I know this because I know someone who works in a local government entity, they've got a big piece of paper on the wall. Okay, it's a computer screen, but anyway. And they basically, so they're tracking the blockchain. And all of it's anonymous. But then one day something happens and they work out that, oh, that bit in the blockchain is Jimmy. Mm-hmm. Cool, cool. And then one day he transacts, oh, and that is, and they start putting all these little pieces together. Notwithstanding, you're Luno, you're operating in South Africa. SARS is like, we want all the details if everyone sent it to us. And they're like, cool, what format do you want it in? I work for a stockbroker.
Do you want PDF or CSV?
Yeah, I used to work for a stockbroker. Every year, we would basically do an upload dump into SARS. What's your format?
So here's the interesting thing. You bring up the governments thing, and I attended an event that I'm probably not allowed to speak on. But in this event, it was a conversation around it was grey listing related. But it kind of got into trackings and things. And you say you know somebody here. I know somebody that sits within an international government's state security services, and they have software that tracks transactions on the blockchain. So as you said, yes, they might be able to figure out who Jimmy is and all of that.
Yeah, so lots
but
of
beyond
anon,
that...
But they start piecing it together over
time. No, but beyond
time.
That, the tech that they've now got will actually allow you to see through into the blockchain who each individual is. And they say that this is in an effort to ward off fraud and protect the integrity of the blockchain, but you've literally just removed the anonymity around it, which was the whole case behind
the
blockchain.
Well, there was never anonymity in the blockchain. It's just that instead of it being Simon, it was XJVT a long hash. Mm. That wasn't anonymous. That was just like no one knew, no one called me by that whatever 24-letter character hash.
It's not your birth certificate name.
Exactly. But you start piecing it all together. Mm. And then it's really, really simple. If ever you're confused, make money, pay SARS.
That's it. If whatever you owe SARS, pay them your dues. End of story. SARS will not ask questions as long as you pay them their share. And that's what they've said around the crypto conversation as well, is there's been clear regulation from the FSCA around how crypto assets are deemed.
Yeah.
From a SARS perspective, there might be a little bit of confusion, but SARS kind of has two baskets that crypto falls in. And to a certain extent, if you can decide which of the two baskets yours falls within, it decides on the tax treatment. It's either income in nature or capital in nature. That's the one thing I've always loved about SARS. They've always been simple in their analysis. It's either an asset that is capital in nature that you pay capital gains tax on, or it's part of income that is part of your income that you earn, and you tax
on that. And if you're regularly buying and selling within 3 years, it all just becomes income. But here's a fun thing. So Ethereum is now proof of stake rather than proof of work, right? So you own some Ethereums and you hold them for the long term, and it's an asset, so it's capital in nature.
Right.
But then you stake some of it and you earn some fee for staking.
That interest is income in nature.
Boom, boom.
Subject
Same
to
thing.
Interest. Yes.
Two different treatments.
Yes, 100%. But again, this is the thing with the receiver of revenue. They've always been clear cut and simple in their regulation, is to say you're earning from this particular thing. How you're earning is for you to classify to us and notify us. But what we're not going to allow is for you to not pay tax on it.
Correct. Yeah. No. So, I mean, the whole, there was all this excitement on the Twitters, and I'm like, guys, come on, it just pays your monies. Like, you know, they're like, oh, and I mean, part of the trick is, I mean, if we take it, the next step up is Saab, because I can easily put money into a blockchain in South Africa and pull it out in a different market, the US or whatever the case may be. And then it's like, suddenly, hang on, you've got some foreign exchange limitations in this country.
You thought you could, Si.
You thought you could.
No, yes. you say that because, as you say that, I remember something very distinct that came out last week, Friday, I think. I keep an eye on a couple of public things. There's a Government Gazette website that notifies you around Government Gazettes because they're mandatory to be put out. This same Government Gazette website is where Saab, the South African Reserve Bank, puts out its notices. There was a conversation we had on our podcast several episodes ago around Saab forfeitures and the precedent that was set by the case involving Berdine Oerdendal and the seizures there, and subsequent to the seizures of funds in Steinhoff's bank accounts and all of that, right? You would think that you can now move your crypto to anywhere and you are safe. You are not. As of last week, Friday, I saw the first ever forfeiture and seizure of a crypto balance. The funds were sitting in a company, in a crypto service provider, so similar to a Luno, right? And there was a forfeiture, a seizure order by the Saab to seize crypto. So they're going to seize the funds before they even leave the country if they breach exchange control. So no, you can't just move the crypto anymore.
Well, you can, because I can put it into a hardware wallet.
Yes.
I keep my crypto in a hardware wallet. Love me some crypto exchanges.
And well done, Simon. You've just given the Saab and SARS a new thing to come after us for. Thanks. Thanks for that. To our community, I apologize on behalf of Simon because he didn't think that through.
Sorry.
But that's it, right? So to come back to the SARS aspect of it, SARS is going to want their pound of flesh, no matter what you do with the business.
All the folks who were like, they were like, oh no, crypto shouldn't be taxed. Like, in what world? In what world? Yeah.
Nope. That's never going to happen. Let's move on to our picks, because we've got a couple of them to run through. And there's various reasons why we're having them on the wall. Are we going to start off local or are we going to start off offshore?
Let's start local.
Okay, let's start local. Blue Label Telecoms. This week I had a conversation around technical insolvency, right? And the South African Broadcasting Corporation, the SABC, is technically insolvent. Multi-Choice is technically insolvent. The Post Office is technically insolvent.
No, the Post Office is just insolvent.
Technically, they're in business rescue. So they've come back from a couple of things, right? But Blue Label Telecoms, Cell C, is technically insolvent. They have been for quite some time. They've been needing to turn around that business. How do we feel about Blue Label as a stock?
No,
there we go. Straight into
it
a void.
It used to be a great business.
Okay.
And then they bought a telco. And not just they bought a telco, they bought like number three in a market that's not big enough to sustain a small number three.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we could do three, but I still think MTN, Rain, Saucy, bulk up one time, become one entity.
As Blue Label Telco.
Sure.
As Blue Label, do you raise capital? Because Blue Label, you're not going to go buy MTN. That's not happening. But as Blue Label, do you buy a Telkom? Because that's a telco that's got the fiber aspect of the business down quite nicely. The share price is battered at 20-something rand. MTN tried it. They're not going to get it. Vodacom's not likely to be interested. Do you make that move and say, double down on the telcos? I bought one. It didn't work. Let me buy a second. Maybe that solves the problem. Look, they've got great fiber infrastructure, right?
But exactly, they've got really great fiber. Look, there's no more copper left, but that's fine. They've got the fiber infrastructure. They've got Telkom Mobile, which is, mm-hmm. I don't know, more or less the same size as Cell C. Merge those together. And then Blue Label's got their core legacy business, which is selling power and mm-hmm. data and airtime and everything else.
Do you do it? Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Telkom, but to be fair, so Telkom's unbundling that SwiftNet business.
Yeah.
So you're going to lose off those towers.
Sure, but you don't want your own towers.
You're fine, because clearly when you were with Cell C, you were happy to sell off your towers anyway. So $6.5 billion goes off. Or do you wait until that unbundling happens? $6.5 billion goes off. The share price comes down. And then you're like, cool.
Paid down a whole truckload with that. That would be audacious for the Levy brothers, but audacious is kind of their middle name sometimes.
Right. But the other thing you have to contend with there is, what will the government say? Because they are still, it is still an SOC. It is still a state-owned company. We can't forget that part.
They don't have the golden share anymore, but they do have the significant influence. Stakeholder. Mm-hmm. So I suppose it depends. I mean, Blue Label wouldn't be doing that for cash. Blue Label ain't got the cash. So it's going to be a script deal. So then government ends up owning some Blue Label.
You know what? Stranger things have happened.
I got to say, looking at this price, I mean, the stock's up from 240 to 560. I don't like profitable telcos. Mm-hmm. Why do I want to buy a bankrupt telco?
Okay. Fair enough. Blue Label is going through a void. Afrimat is the other one. They gave us a 6-month trading update this week. Very interesting update. I've spoken to Afrimat in the past just around how their business is shaping up, where they're focusing, and that sort of thing. We have been saying we're going to get a little more bullish around the mining sector and the resources sector going into the next bull run. Is Afrimat worth considering?
Yeah, I do wish it had fallen off more. A couple of things. I mean, the market saw this coming because it's Lafarge. I mean, you probably spoke to Andreas van Heerden as well at year end 6 months ago.
Well, I spoke to them when they announced the Lafarge acquisition, R1 billion acquisition. That was definitely a conversation we had.
Sure. And it was going to be, it wasn't going to make the money in the first year. There was a lot to fix. And Andreas was completely open with that. There's a lot to do here, et cetera, et cetera. If anyone can fix, it is the Afrimat team. They've essentially seconded the CFOs at Peter de Wit, if memory serves correct, to go and make this all work. So they were going to have bad numbers because of Lafarge. Iron ore hasn't helped. There's been one or two other small bits in there. But, you know, if the China story starts to happen and the $142 billion's kicking in, that's going to help things such as iron ore. They will get Lafarge working. Our president wants to make this country into a construction site. We've heard that before.
We have.
But all of this starts to play. And I think Afrimat, you know, I liked it a heck lot more at sub 50, which it was.
Yeah, I was going to say, what price are you liking? Because, I mean, 65 Rand at the moment. We did get to 50. Sub 50 was probably 2021 ish. We dipped briefly below around 2022, 2023 ish. But we've since, I mean, I liked it at 50. And that was around the time the Lafarge acquisition went through and the announcement came through. And we saw it kind of bump up from there. Do we like it at 65 at the moment, or is there an alternative we'd like to look at?
So, I mean, your alternatives is the likes of, in the same sort of space, would be a PPC, but that's a little bit too concentrated in just cement. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got the construction materials business, which has been up 100% a year for the last 2 years. And some of that has been Transnet spend, which has been important. I think, I mean, what are they going to earn? So not for this current financial year, for the 2026 financial year. This is a stock that's going to earn 5 Rand in HEPS, maybe. I'm running numbers. Don't sue me if I'm, you know.
Don't quote him.
there we go. 13 forward PE. Not bad for a little construction business. And of course, they don't do the constructing.
They don't. They just don't take on that risk. They just supply the material.
What do? They dig holes. Hmm. They just do it really well. I mean, like, come on.
Find something and do it well.
$65. I was truthfully, because when it was sub 50, and it's been there a couple of times in the last year or so, I kept on wanting to, and they never pulled the trigger for one reason or another. If you look at just from a purely technical perspective, it's nicely off the highs. I'd hoped this trading update would bring more selling. It turns out the market's a little smarter.
A little too bullish on it. Yeah. I think I also like it closer to that 50 Rand level if I have to pick a level. But we do like the prospects of the stock. And I suppose we'd find a spot in our wall. It might fall into easy money, or we like it. We're definitely not neutral about it. And I don't think there is a reasonable alternative for it, so it'll probably land up either in free money or whether we like it. We'll just decide where it goes and we'll put it up on the wall. International picks.
Yeah.
Let's start with Google because I've got a bit of a conspiracy theory around our second pick. Google okay. is, obviously we spoke about the Google developments in our Market Matters, and do we like the stock if there is, I don't even know what an unbundling of Google looks like. Okay, let's not speculate on what might not happen.
But you're right. Like,
do
some
we like
unbundling
at the moment?
If Amazon has to unbundle AWS, it's nice, it's clean, we understand it, and truthfully, we like them separate. Google, so Google is probably fairly valued if you look back at a decade of price earnings and the forward PE. It's growing along. The question you have to ask yourself is their Google search. You go to google.com and it's just become a mess. It's mm-hmm. just a horror in terms of, as I said, I hardly ever use it anymore. So can they get that right? And what about AI? You know, ChatGPT, OpenAI is going to launch a search product at some point. Perplexity is going to launch a search product at some point as well. They're all going to bring their search ones on it. Does this threaten Google's dominance in search? And it is dominant in search. And I got to say, I'm not sure that it does, because you and I might be chatting about OpenAI and Perplexity and others. I'm not sure my sister is, or mm-hmm. my wife, or those other folks.
The non-nerds of the world.
Yeah.
The normal people.
Who just go to Google, who use Chrome, and when That's they it. Search, they go to the toolbar, type it in, and it comes up.
And it generates whatever they
and
want.
And they're like, these aren't as good as before. But you know, no one's coming to me of my non-nerd friends and saying, so Google's trash, what's the new one? Mm-hmm. They're all just managing with the trash Google.
Also, OpenAI, you'd think, might pose an some sort of threat, but when you've got the balance sheet the size of Google, you just buy the OpenAI when they're done. Let somebody else develop the tech, and then go make an offer before it goes public. Or if it goes public, deploy some cash into buying up a significant stake, and then buy it out that way. I mean, Facebook did it with WhatsApp. Have we not seen this playbook before?
Yeah.
It's very easy to just have somebody else do all the grunt work and then say, okay, cool, we're going to now bring that revenue in-house because your balance sheet is purely that big. So I don't know if it's really a threat.
And they, I mean, they fumbled AI. They undoubtedly had a lead, but they just absolutely fumbled it. And it's a classic innovator's dilemma.
So Nokia, they pulled a Nokia, but they're alive and we're okay with them. How do we feel about them? Neutral about them?
Neutral.
Neutral about them.
Seems a bit of a wuss out, but if we can take a neutral.
BlackRock.
Okay.
Oh, right. So, first of all, I want to just preface this by saying that the situation's happening in Florida. Nobody wants to lose their homes. Nobody wants to lose their lives. Our thoughts go out to the people that are the victims of Hurricane Milton. We still don't know why hurricanes are named the way they are. Someone will give us an answer one day. But I heard an interesting conspiracy theory around the fact that where the hurricane is going through in the US, there have been significant lithium deposits that have been found. And the activist individuals that are residents of that area that did not want mining to take place there had gone out and had gone out in protest of all of these things, right? And as a result of that, there was a company that a couple of weeks or months ago was granted mining rights to mine that lithium, also granted, I think, to the tune of some $250 million in grants for the mining purposes. And before mining has even commenced, BlackRock took an equity stake in that company. Now, you piece all of those things together and you can really get a conspiracy theory around anything, but that seems like a very serious allegation, which is a similar allegation to what we heard around the disaster that happened in Hawaii involving everybody's properties except a certain celebrity whose properties were not harmed or not burnt down in the fires and all of that in Hawaii. And you start to wonder, you can go down these rabbit holes. But BlackRock as a company, let's not go down the rabbit hole, because the rabbit hole was just a side quest. The main quest is it on our wall?
So intuitively, a asset manager, BlackRock, in a rising equity market, it's a good deal. Markets go up 10%. They make 10% more fees and then revenue, and maybe they get some performance on top of it. Their problem is, I don't know, they're $9 trillion dollar.
Yeah.
And they could almost pay off US debt, could pay a quarter of the US debt, just like somewhere right.
So here's the thing about BlackRock that's particularly interesting, right? Assets under management, yes, $9 trillion. But BlackRock has a stake in every company.
Yeah.
We're going to pull the mind map of the companies that BlackRock has a stake in. And BlackRock has a stake in banks. And banks have stakes in other things. But BlackRock finances, I think they are the largest asset manager.
Yeah.
On the continent. Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the world, sorry.
In the world.
Largest asset manager in the world. Easily, they move the needle. This is one of those times where you have no doubt about it. If there is a shift made by BlackRock from an investment point of view, it can be enough to move the needle. Is it enough to make our wall? Because that's the true measure.
Because I think, in 1 year, it's up almost 50%. I think that the good news that is out there in terms of bull markets and stuff, I think the market has kind of noticed this. Pricing in a PE north of 20, price to book of 3.5. So 9 trillion of AUM, it's basically selling at 15 times assets under management. That is a lot.
That sounds expensive. Do we have an alternative? Because I suspect this is where we're going with this. There must be an alternative out there.
In the US space.
Doesn't have to be in the US.
Well, how about South Africa, where we've got...
We added Coro last week, Coronation.
Yeah, I was going to say, to Coro, which we put in last week, which is a market cap of 13 billion and AUM of 700.
Asset manager sitting outside of South Africa. Outside of the US, I suppose.
Yeah.
Are there any good European ones?
I don't know. Europe is a mess.
The other side of the coin.
I don't know of any. And in the, so it would be someone like a Vanguard or something, but of course they're not listed. They're actually a mutual. So that's not going to help.
I did have an alternative, but as you say listed, I think about the fact that this one might not be listed, and it would be the closest thing. So Vanguard is number two in terms of assets under management. Mm-hmm. UBS sits third. Obviously, UBS having bought out Credit Suisse. You're in Switzerland. Then you're back in the US. Really, the top out of the top eight. Only UBS is not based in the US.
So then what about something like a Charles Schwab?
Okay.
Because they've got some assets. There they are. I can never remember their share code. They've got some assets under management. They're a little bit cheaper, not a heck of a lot cheaper, but certainly a bit cheaper. They do assets under management, but they do transactions. I mean, I've been keeping an eye on daily value trade in the JC, and forever it was stuck at 15, 16 billion a day, which is nothing. Mm. And now it's sitting 20 plus billion on many, many days, which means basically revenues for all people involved in the game, brokers, exchanges, and everyone else, is up a third suddenly in the last little bit. And that certainly helps the JSC. It should also markedly help stockbrokers.
That could work. Charles Schwab should be the alternative that we have there. My alternative that I would love to have on the list, which we simply cannot have on the list, maybe one day we'll be able to build one of our own, is the Saudi Public Investment Fund.
Well, yeah.
Because the PIF, it makes me excited to discuss sovereign wealth funds. Oh,
they are huge fun. Hey, well, you go done, dig into that Norwegian
$925 billion in assets estimated. Yeah. So just under $1 trillion in assets. And it's an exceptionally well-managed sovereign wealth fund. One day we'll talk about our own sovereign wealth fund and our ambitions around that. But for now, that's been Investor Insights. If you've missed our conversations, you know where to find them. I'm going to stop telling people where to find them, because by now you should know us. You know where we are, and you know how to get hold of us. Until next time, investing isn't hard. Just try it.